Well, there was someone else, someone in the Bible that wanted to be a little nearer to God, and I'm going to take a little diversion from the series we've been in to look at this fellow, Nehemiah, and I'm actually doing this because I knew most of the guys wouldn't be here this morning, and I wanted to give a lesson that would be hopefully motivating and encouraging for the women folk among us. Now, Nehemiah is an interesting guy. I think it's interesting that we ended on that song. I know what the songs are going to be ahead of time, but I really don't because I don't ever look at the list. So so I really didn't know this song was coming up. And but if you think about Nehemiah, and we'll go over the story here in just a minute, but here's Nehemiah living in another country, has grown up in that country, never known Israel as his own, never been there, never visited Israel. And he has a heart to go and to do and to be there and to help encourage the people and to clean up the problems. And you have to realize that Nehemiah was in a good spot where he was in Babylon. He was in a high position of honor. He probably had things going well for him. He may have had indoor plumbing and hot and cold water. Things were good for Nehemiah. And for him to go to Israel was a sacrifice for him, and to Judah more specifically. The story of Nehemiah is intriguing and powerful. It is compelling and motivating. It is full of wonderful strategies and insights for wise living and many analogies for us to be drawn and to reflect on in our own lives as well. It's a very important story for men, but maybe even more so for women to hear, because you are in many respects the wall builders of our society, our culture, our world. Now that can have a negative connotation. We put up walls. That's not what I'm talking about. But I mean to be in the positive connotations of defense. Now see if you can relate to any of these concepts. The need to protect yourself, your family, from the forces of evil. The need to maintain faith, as you are affronted by the enemy, scorned, laughed at, mocked, ridiculed, prodded. The need to maintain faith when the enemy steps up the attack and takes it to a higher level to actually fight the fight. The need to prioritize difficult decisions. The need to make the most of precious time as an influencer over others. We have those such a short window of time we begin to realize as the kids get older, as we get older, and the need to review, to correct, to review, to correct, to review, and to correct again. Nehemiah is certainly one of the most inspiring figures of the Bible. And the book of Nehemiah is almost perfect. You read through the story, and you see these wonderful transformations taking place, this wonderful reform going on. And you think to yourself, yes, we're going to get through one book of the Old Testament and end on a high note. But alas, we get to the last chapter. And there's always the human frailty and the need for more grace that shows up. Nehemiah is a very familiar story, although if you're like me, you might need a little refresher of some of the events and how it is that we get to the book of Nehemiah. Okay. Backing up a little bit in the story, this is going to be really interesting. Nehemiah is down in Babylon. But before Babylon, we had Israel and Judah, right? And the kingdom split in about 931 B.C. And the northern kingdom lasted about 250 years, carried off to captivity to Assyria, right? And the southern tribes lasted an additional 150 years or so and carried off to Babylon, B for Babylon. Now, there are actually three different deportations to Babylon, 605, 597, 586 is the big one. That was the final scourge of Jerusalem. And then that's it for Israel and for Judah for all practical purposes. They go down to Babylon, never to be heard from again. Well, not exactly. After a little time, they get to come back. And so under three different returns back to the land, you have, and this is easy to remember the order of this, because it's in the order of Zen. So you have Zerubbabel in 537. In 516, the temple is rebuilt. and these dates are kind of important, so hang with me here. Ezra comes back in 458. Now notice there's a pretty good period of time between 537 and 458. Zerubbabel is the guy that probably brings back a good number of people. Ezra brings back some more, and under Ezra they get some reintroduced to the law. Zerubbabel is in charge of the temple, and then under Nehemiah they're going to rebuild the walls. And so now picture this though. Here's Nehemiah down in Babylon, and Babylon is a wonderful place to live. I guess if you're on the good side of the king anyhow. And it's a modern place. It's majestic. It just ooze of power everywhere you go. There's this major gate that they go through, the Ishtar Gate, and it's lined with all these golden lions. And it was just spectacular. Nehemiah's down there in Babylon, and he's seen now these two groups who have come back to the land. Well, he actually hadn't seen two groups come back to the land because, well, the first group came back about 90 years before Nehemiah comes back, and so Nehemiah wasn't around for that first group. But he knows about the first group having come back to the land. And he's seen the second group go back to the land. And Nehemiah is a very important official in the king's court in Babylon. He's a cupbearer. Now, the cupbearer, you might think of that as not being so very significant, but it's very significant because the cupbearer is the guy that has to drink a little bit of the king's juice before he gives it to the king, or whatever it was he was drinking. And that's an important job, because if you take a drink of the drink and you die, then the king doesn't have to die, and so you're kind of making a little sacrifice for the king. Well, think about this. You had to have a great level of trust by the king to be the cupbearer, because cupbearers could be bribed. Cupbearers could be convinced that the king needs to be replaced. And so the cupbearer has a place of great importance and high honor, and had a close relationship oftentimes with the king. So Nehemiah is the cupbearer of King Artaxerxes, who has been the king for 20 years now in Babylon. And Nehemiah's brother comes back from the land, having gone on a Holy Land tour. Undoubtedly, he was probably the guide. You know, the guides that lead these tours, if you take 20 or more people with you, you get the tour for free. So he was probably the guide, got the free tour, and he came back and he gave a report of what was happening in the land. And it wasn't a good report, and we'll see that. And Nehemiah is discouraged by this, and he's sad, and his countenance falls. But it would be helpful for us to know a little bit more of the history, even than what the Bible tells us, and this is a well-attested account. First of all, though, we know that from the biblical account, life was rough there. We know that the Samaritans, who were basically the Jewish people from the north, the Israelites, that had been carried off to Assyria, and when the Assyrians, remember, when they take people out of the land, they're like the Borg. They just, you know, you will be assimilated. Assimilation is inevitable. Resistance is futile. You are coming to Assyria, and there's no resistance to this. And they basically take everyone out, and then they put some of their own people back in there. And they'll leave a few of the Israelites behind, the worst of the worst. And so that becomes the Samaritans. And we know the story of the Samaritans all the way through the New Testament. They're antagonistic of the Judahites and of the, quote, true Jewish people, those who are not a mixture. And there's confrontation that goes on between them. So we know that there was difficulty from that, those pesky Samaritans. But we also know that there was a fellow by the name of Mega Bezos. And you won't find his name in the Bible, but you can remember him because he's like the big Bezos. He's the Mega Bezos. And he was the Syrian governor or satrap. Now, as opposed to Assyria, Babylon works things a little differently. So when the Babylonians took you out, they would not take all of you, although they would take a lot. And in fact, they took most of Judah. But they allowed them to return because they began to realize it's to our benefit if the people that are from there actually live there because they know the land. And there's no way we can keep everyone in Babylon that we capture. And so we're going to let people come back. And as long as they pay taxes and are loyal to me, I'm good with that, the king says. And so they have their somewhat of their own autonomy, some of their own independence. And so, but the king would appoint satraps or governors over these different regions. Now the region that went from Babylon, and hopefully you can picture this your mind, but the region went from Babylon, from the Euphrates River, all the way to the Mediterranean, and all the way down to Egypt. That was basically considered the land on this side of the river. In fact, you'll see, as you read through Nehemiah, you see that phrase, something about this side of the river, those on this side of the river. And that was actually a term that was used in Akkadian, in Sumerian, in Ammonite documents, in Egyptian documents. You'll see this phrase, this side of the river. And it refers to that whole area of land from Euphrates River all the way down to the river of Egypt. Now, of course, the Bible also refers to that vast area of land, and God calls it His land. He says, this is the land that you will have, and I will restore this to you and all that, right? So we know that. But in the records of those days, they didn't call it that. They just called it the river, the land of the side of the river. Now, that area was also generally known as Syria at this time. Now, this is a little confusing to people. How does Syria relate to Assyria? Well, Assyria has two more letters than Syria. And literally, that's how it relates, because it actually became... Syria is really a shortened form of Assyria. Now, so Assyria ultimately... Now, when we speak of Assyria, it's usually in a different time than Syria. So that's a different... another delineation. When you see discussion about Assyria, that's before they became known as Syria. So Syria is kind of a generalization of Assyria, and ultimately becomes a little broader area, that whole area from in that river span. So, back up. Megabazos is the Syrian governor. Now, he's also the brother-in-law of the king. So he was appointed that because of his relationship to the king. And Megabazos has some issues, and he begins to decide that he's going to revolt against the kingdom. And so he does. And he does this 4 years before Nehemiah is going to go to the land. And he does this for 2 years. And what that produces then is a civil war in that region of Syria. Now, civil wars, if anyone in history will tell you, are typically the worst kind of wars. Because there you're, it's brother fighting against brother. It's our man against our man. It's not like you just got the guys with the red shirts against the guys with the blue shirts and vice versa. You don't know who you're fighting. It's a terrible kind of war, and it creates disharmony. It creates difficulties. It creates stresses. It creates great tumult and trials. And it would have been a very difficult time. So, 4 years before Nehemiah, this Megabazos creates this strife. This lasts for 2 years, and then they come to an agreement. He basically decides to retire, and he goes off the scene. But it leaves this instability in the region. Now, what you also need to know about this history is that Egypt is under the control of Babylon at this time, because Babylon has basically captured the whole world. But Egypt is always, well, I wish Rafa were here, but... Egypt is always Egypt, all right? And for some reason, they always are pushing back. And Egypt, for some reason, will always be Egypt, it seems. There will never be a time when there is no Egypt. And so they're under control of Babylon, but they're pushing back, and there's always resistance. For one thing, they're a long ways away from the capital and a lot of areas separating them. What's right in between Egypt and Babylon? Israel. And not as a crow flies per se, because if you actually got in a plane, you would not go over Israel at all. But as the trade routes were, that's how you would go. There's no way to get there except going through Israel. So Israel is a very, very important spot, and particularly Judah and Jerusalem, her capital. So this then the king sees, Nehemiah comes to the king and he says, "Oh, king, things are terrible. King says, why are you so sad? And we'll see the count in just a minute. And he says, oh, why shouldn't I be sad? Oh, Yvette, why shouldn't I be sad? My people, you know? And the king says, well, you know, well, what do you want to do about this? Well, let me go back to my land and let me help things out. And the king, so you think to yourself, well, the king says, okay, go do it. And you think, wow, the king really likes Nehemiah. Well, that may very well be, and it probably is true, that he had a certain confidence in him, a relationship with him, because he was the cupbearer. But also, this was in the king's interest, because he wanted to make sure that there was stability in the land. And if you stabilize Judah, it helps to bring stability to the whole region, and that would be very important to King Artaxerxes. So there's always an ulterior motive in the background. It's not just altruism on his behalf. excuse me. So Nehemiah mourns over the state of his homeland, stands before the king saddened, and the king asks why his long face, and he ultimately gets to go back into the land. So Nehemiah returns to rebuild the walls. But now before we get there, let me ask you a question. How long did it take to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem? Do you know? Did it take 2 decades, 2 years, or 2 months? Now, before you answer that, remember these are high walls. Okay, these are. This is not one of the walls that Nehemiah. I keep wanting to say Jeremiah. If I say Jeremiah this morning, just know that I really mean Nehemiah. Okay. Nehemiah, this is not the wall that Nehemiah, but it would be very similar to. So this is not like a little short wall. It's not like the wall you have behind your house, maybe. This is not a retaining wall. This is a fortress wall, the big wall. And when Nehemiah rebuilt it, now it wasn't as vast as it was during the time of David reigning. It wasn't as vast as it would be later during the time of the Maccabees and on when Herod came into the scene. But it's still a good area. It's still a good-sized wall. So, and it's tall. Big wall. And it had to be rebuilt almost entirely from scratch. So, how long do you think it took? 2 months. Well, obviously, the answer is 2 months. So, it takes actually 52 days to rebuild the walls. Despite harassment from the enemy, death threats, people working with a weapon in their sheath, and some having a weapon in one hand and a trowel in the other. Despite the immensity of the project, smaller than it would be in future times, but still a very large project, this is quite a feat. And it's unbelievable, in fact. And so much so that when it was completed, their very own enemies said, this is a work that only God could have done. So the wall was finished on this day, and it was 52 days total, and it happened when all of our enemies heard of it, and all the nations around us saw these things, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was done by our God. Now, one of the things I love about the way Nehemiah writes is he writes in first person. It's almost unlike almost any of the books in the Old Testament. So you see, Nehemiah says, "Yeah, this is what we were doing." And he says, "I and me, and this is what I was thinking, and this is what I prayed." I love that because it's so personal. And he said, so they perceive that this was done by our God. He personalizes it. And what I want you to see is that while it took 52 days to rebuild the walls, it will take more than 12 years to transform the people's hearts. The reshaping of a heart takes much longer than the building of a wall. And part of this, the reason for this is that we so quickly turn and forget, and it only takes a generation or two for everything to be completely broken down within our own thinking processes. We'll see the same sins produced by these people as was done in Ezra's day, only 12, 15 years before this. We'll see the same sins committed against promises these guys will make, and we won't get to this week, But these people in Nehemiah's day will sit down and they will all sign a big contract. There'll be 20 of these guys all line up and say, yes, I guarantee we're not going to do this, 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 and this. And by the time you flip the page to the last chapter, they're doing this, 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 but not that. They did pretty good, 4 out of 5 errors. And it just doesn't take long for us to turn the wrong direction. But this is a further testimony. The very fact that it takes so much time to correct people's hearts, the very fact that people so quickly turn away and forget, is a testimony not only to the grace of God, but also to His standing promise of provision to keep a remnant in Israel. Because if you think about it, if you took any other people, any other time, other than what God had said, there will remain, everyone would have gone astray within just a generation or two. There would have been nothing of them. So it has to be God who retains and continues on with this this remnant of true Israel, those who are the true followers of Yahweh. It's a startling realization also of the difficulties of turning the ship around once it gets going the wrong direction. Now, the bigger the ship is, the harder it is and the longer it takes to turn. In the company I work for, we like to refer to ourselves as the PT boat. Now, the PT boat is the little boat compared to the big, I lost my terminology now, any of the big ships. What? Aircraft carrier. That's a good one. And so here you got this big aircraft carrier. That's the companies we're fighting. That's the Goliath. And here's us little PT boat. Well, the big aircraft carrier decides, oh, we need to go over there. So they go, turn the rudders or whatever they do. And so a little guy goes down there and turns his little wheel, I'm sure. And this big rudder turns. And about 4 hours later, the boat is able to turn, 15 degrees. Well, we're a little PT boat. We go, turn the rudders. And so Eric, the only guy that works for the company, does this. And it doesn't take very long at all. And so you see, the smaller you are, the faster, more nimble you are, the quicker you're able to turn and reshape. And so every day I do something different, which means I don't really ever get anything done. But that's another story. So, but when you got a big ship, the bigger the ship is and the more junk you pile up on that ship to make it bigger, the harder it is to turn. Same thing is true with planes, interestingly enough. And that is, the faster they go, the longer it takes for that plane to turn. So you got there's a great thing with having fast planes. Planes that can go Mach 6. It's like the record. Man, we can go really fast, Mach 6. Oh, but by the way, if we need to turn, it also means it's going to take us about 6 minutes to turn and get back over here, because we're going so fast that by the time we start to turn, we're already on the other side of the world. And so that's the bad side about something that goes very fast. And this happens, has great analogy for our lives as well. So you start going really fast the wrong direction, and it's going to take you a long time to get going back the right way. Nehemiah, right away we will see great character of Nehemiah. Nehemiah, and I'm just going to kind of read through here and make some comments as we go through here. And I hope you see the value in this great story. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. And it came to pass in the month of Chislev in the 12th year, as I was in Shushan, the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brethren, and a lot of scholars believe that was actually his brother, came with men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. And so it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. First of all, again, you have to realize this is a guy that's never been there before. And he has such a heart for this place. And one of the reasons, I believe, is that he has a true understanding of God, His word, and the value that God had placed in Jerusalem in particular. This is like the song we sang, I want to be closer to Thee, O Lord. in order to be close to God, in the true sense, in the most literal sense, for Nehemiah was to be in Jerusalem. But Nehemiah had never been there. And he had a heart for a place that he'd never seen. Now, I can't imagine. You know, the closest we can get to this thinking is when the Christian Children's Fund, or whatever it is, comes on TV with the pictures of the poor kids, and you've never been there, but they can make you feel like, wow, I really care for these kids. Well, that's about as close as we can probably get, but we get to see the pictures. Nehemiah didn't see that. All he heard was some words, some descriptions of this place, and he has a true heart for what the way it should be. And I said, I pray, Lord God of heaven, oh great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments, please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open. He was pleading, kind of like when Tina was pushing the button to turn on her laptop after it had, like that. She was telling me that it decided to go poof off, so she was saying, please, Lord, please, Lord, please, Lord. Right? I'm sure this is what Nehemiah was doing. And let your eye, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Again, this is quality character guy. He says, both my father's house and I have sinned. Now, this is a man, again, living in luxury, had all that he needed, didn't have to make life difficult for himself, but he makes his petition first to God. He humbles himself. He repents. He has a wonderful principle. When things go wrong, first look to see if there's anything you've done to add to the problem. Now, that's very appropriate. It doesn't mean that you always are the problem. You may not even have added to it, like Job. You know, Job was there, didn't really do anything. His friends say, you did it all. I said, no, I haven't done anything. But it's a good principle to say, is there anything I've done to add to this problem? And then confess whatever you can and hope that God fixes everything else. It's just an opportunity to inspect yourself, to reflect God's thinking. And we also know that Nehemiah was respected. He was appreciated. He was important to the king. And he was also probably very busy. But he somehow knows enough of the word to know that there's something missing, and that God's made these promises that are out there. Now, of course, this was a common cry. This was well known and attested fact that they would return to the land, that there would be this new exodus. It was Ezekiel's cry that they would be returning back someday. And the problem is Nehemiah hasn't seen the exodus. He's not so caught up in the big event that he forgets to do the little stuff. He's not so caught up in dreaming of the day when that he ceases to do the stuff that he needs to do for the day. And so he's a very practical person. And he goes on, remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations, but if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out to the farthest parts of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. Verse 10, now these are your servants and your people, whom you have been redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name. And let your servant prosper this day, I pray, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, for I was the king's cupbearer. And there we find out just who he really is. And now he has to get to see why it is he's standing before the king. And so then in the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Artaxerxes, the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, this is his 20th year of reign, when wine was brought to me, I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now previously I had not been depressed in the king's presence. So the king said to me, why do you appear depressed? You're not sick. What can this be other than sadness of heart? And this made me very fearful. Why? Well, he's supposed to, first of all, have a certain countenance. That's his job. So when the king says, what's wrong with you? Now he realizes, uh-oh, the king knows. And we see from the fact that he's fearful that he wasn't going before the king and going, intentionally looking sad so that the king would ask him. It's not like he's going, hey, hint, hint. Here's your cup for the day. I'm okay, really. Just don't worry about me. Here's your cup. You got your cup. It wasn't like that. He was truly sad. And he was fearful because why? He now knows that he's got to answer the king. And now he has a choice to make. Do I just tell the king, it's nothing. Don't worry about it. You're a king. I'm cupbearer. It shouldn't concern you. Could have done that. But he says, okay, this is my chance. The Lord has given me an opportunity, and now I have to make a choice. And you know, by the way, this is what the way I feel anytime I'm confronted with an opportunity to share the gospel with someone. Lord, please let me have an opportunity to talk to this person. And then when the opportunity comes, I'm fearful. Because now I know the opportunity has come, and now I either have to make the choice to obey or to just say, you know, how's it going today? And move on, right? So I replied to the king, O king, live forever. Why would I not appear dejected when the city with the graves of my ancestors lies desolate and its gates destroyed by fire? And the king responded, what do you want? And I quickly pray. I love that. This had to have been written by Nehemiah because he's like so honest with it. He's like, so I was like, Lord, here's my chance. I'm going to be talking to Artaxerxes in just a minute. And I'm going to ask him what I want, so please grant it to me. And this is like the longest prayer probably ever in the shortest period of time. And to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, if the king is so inclined, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, dispatch me to Judah, to the city with the graves of my ancestors, so that I can rebuild it. Now again, we know from the history that this was to Artaxerxes' favor. And he's not just saying, let me go to Judah. He says, dispatch me to Judah. Send me. Make this a part of my job and let me do this thing. And so the king granted me the request, for the good hand of my God was on me. And then I went to the governors of the Trans-Euphrates. He also, I didn't put this in there, but he also said, oh, and while I'm doing that, please give me a letter of safe travel and also give me a letter to the wood people, to your wood people, to give me some wood to take down there with me so I can rebuild the walls and the temple and do some work there. Excuse me. So this happened, and I went to the Trans-Euphrates. There it is. There's the phrase, Trans-Euphrates, that which is on the other side of the Euphrates, the other side of the river. And I presented to them the letters from the king, and the king has sent me officers of the army and horsemen. And now you see the first opposition. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard all this, they were very displeased that someone had come to seek benefit for the Israelites. So here you have the people in the land that were part of the underground opposition, so to speak. And they were probably a part of this group that really were not in favor so much of Babylon being in rule, doing everything that they can to bring and to add to the stability of the region. So they know when this thing happens, it's not going to be a good thing. Excuse me. Now we'll see that Nehemiah stands when others sit. We'll see that he is bold but prayerful. That he is not a superman, but he's just humble and wise and full of faith and very faithful. Now you can't see that picture at all, but basically it's a kind of a cool artist rendering of the walls. And part of the story, and you can't, and because you can't really tell what that is, but that's a guy standing there with a spear, and you know, you just picture this rebuilding project going on, the vastness of these walls, and people, you know, large stones, a lot of hard labor being produced in a very short period of time, but it wasn't just all work because they also had to fortify as they were working, and so. This is a story of great faith. And now we see the confrontation. So I came to Jerusalem and I was there 3 days. And then I rose in the night, I and just a few men with me. And he goes on to talk about how he went throughout the city in the middle of the night just kind of traveled around with his, he was on a horse, and he's just checking out the walls and realizing, man, they're in really, really, really bad shape. And I said to them, you see, and so he gathers all the people then the next day. And he says, you see the distress that we're in, how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem. We may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, let us rise up and build. Then they set their hands to this good work. Now, I was going to put this in a couple of slides, but I'll go ahead and talk about it now. We often think of, let me back up. I think in many ways, Nehemiah is an evangelist to his own people. Now, you don't usually think about this, but within a country, whether it be a religious country or not, you have those that are faithful and those that are not. You have those that are of the belief and those that don't have a belief system. Within America, we have Christians and we have non-Christians. Now, not so many years ago, we used to call ourselves a Christian nation. We still had a need to evangelize, right? In Israel, it was no different. So while the nation was God's nation, within the nation, there were many people who were believers and many people who were not believers. Just carnal, everyday, living on, doing their normal stuff. They needed to hear the news. They needed to know who God was. Many of them didn't know anything about Him. So here's Nehemiah. He comes back, and what does he tell them? He says, my God. My God has told me this thing, and he's told him of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and of the king's words. So here's in many respects, Nehemiah is like an evangelist. He's having to come and tell the people the good news. But notice he doesn't sit down and start out with they don't have Bible study. They didn't sit down and do. They didn't have their morning devotionals every day before they started building the walls. They got right to work. Now, there's a principle here, and I think we'll come back to this in a minute. So when Sanballat the Horonite, here are the enemies again, and Tobiah the Ammonite, and now another guy, Geshem, the Arab, heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us. They said, what is this thing you're doing? Will you rebel against the king? And so I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us, therefore we are his servants. We will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. Now remember those words, because one of those three guys, Nehemiah is going to get this thing built. He's going to stay there for 12 years. He's going to leave and come back, we think, probably 3 years later. And within that three-year period of time that he's gone, one of these three guys will have set himself up to actually living in the temple. And Nehemiah says, you have no heritage, no right, no memorial in Jerusalem. Not only because they're the enemy and they're taunting, but also because they are specifically of those God said shall not have any part in Jerusalem. We're going to see this, Tobiah, the Ammonite. And God had a specific decree against the Ammonites. And yet he will end up being in Jerusalem and he'll have to be cast out. But look at what Nehemiah does in all this. The first thing he does, he sets up shop and he strategizes. Number one, he gets to the building of the walls first. Setting up the protection. Rebuilding what has fallen down. He rallies everyone to see the same problems that we see and working on them together as a unified front. And there are just so many areas that this is true and needful in our own lives. If we are going to be successful as a family, we've got to all see the problem together. If we're going to be successful in a church, we have to see the same problems together. If we're going to be successful even within our own personal lives, we have to see the same problems in the same way that God sees them. We have to understand them and know the full... we don't have to understand the full ramifications, but we have to at least know that we're all heading together in this unified session. way. And standing up against the adversity of taunters. He's going to stand. He's going to say, no, we're going to do this thing. We are going to build. Doesn't matter what the taunters have to say against us. And I think that notion of standing is so important. And we often get to thinking that we need to fight. Nehemiah could have done that. Could have gathered the guys together. Said, let's go against Sanballat. Let's go against Tobiah. Let's go against these guys. He didn't. He just said, we're going to stand. This is what we got to do. Got to build the walls. Keep the focus. Keep the eyes on this. This is what we're going to do. We're just going to stand and do this thing. And we get to the New Testament. We find Paul tells us to put on the whole armor of God. Why? So you can go out and fight the enemy. No, so you can stand. Never says fight. Says stand. Stand against the wiles of the devil. You don't wrestle against flesh and blood and principalities and all that. Take up the whole armor of God. Therefore, stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness. And we think that we need to take the offensive, and many times, most often probably, we just need to stand and let God kind of do the rest of it. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty in which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with the yoke of bondage. So there's some strategizing going on. And finally, he's ultimately depending on God. And he says, God of heaven himself will prosper us. No one else is going to do it. It's not going to be because we're great, strong, powerful, almighty. It's because God himself is able to do that. So again, Nehemiah, I think, is kind of the evangelist here in a way. He rallies the troops. He begins to let them know a little bit about this thing of who God is. My God has told me, and we're going to get this thing done. But they got right to the physical work. And he didn't come into the land, start having daily devotions. They came in and secured the borders. Now, not that it's the same for us, because our availability to the Word of God is much, 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 much different than theirs. But sometimes you have to remove certain obstacles first before you get to these other things. People talk about this when you work with, a soup kitchen ministries. And, you're dealing with people that literally sometimes maybe are starving to death. And, you could preach the word to them first and say, you hear the word, and then we'll give you some soup. Well, probably better to give them a little soup and then let them hear the word, right? And this is some of the things you have to do sometimes, is to remove some of those obstacles. Make sure you get to the word, but because that's the only thing that's going to save them, not giving them bread. But sometimes you do have to do some things first. Nehemiah goes on, but it so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall that he was furious and very indignant. Now this is chapter 4. I skipped chapter 3 because in chapter 3 it's basically a whole list of very detailed. This so-and-so family was working on this gate, and they had so many men working on this, and they did that. And then this and this family did this. And it's kind of mundane, and there's some useful information in there, but it's one of those chapters that you tend to read very quickly if you're honest with yourself. And so what happened, though, when we get to 4, we've seen all these guys are doing this work. They did what they set out to do. They're doing the work, and now Sanballat is mad as a hornet's nest. And he was furious, indignant, and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren in the army of Samaria and said, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned? Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, whatever they build, if even a fox goes up against it, he will break down their stone wall. Now this is, you often see this. So when you fight someone, and they begin to realize you may beat them, they begin to just kind of belittle what you're doing. Sure nothing, man. Your wall's just going to fall down. Don't worry about it. On the other hand, we begin to get a little bit worried, and that's what's actually going on. So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height for the people had mind to work. So they're halfway done now. Okay, now watch this. The taunters came in. They had these thoughts. We know what their thoughts are. We built the wall, got it halfway done. And now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, they became very angry, and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and to create confusion. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to God, to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. More strategizing. So here, they made a prayer. First priority, we're not going to do this on our own. We are only doing this by the power of God. But we also set a watch against them day and night. So it's not just that we pray, Lord, do this thing, and we're just going to hope that you solve this thing for us. But there was also a requirement for them to do something as well. They had due diligence. So they had diligence to do what they needed to do. They had a recognition, however, that it's God alone that brings victory. And then there's also some CIA work. Some central intelligence going on because they knew what the enemy was doing. And so sometimes that's helpful for us as well to realize what it is that the enemy is thinking and how it is that the enemy is working. But what I want you to see in this, as we come to a conclusion for today, is that they built the wall. Excuse me. Verse 6. Half of it's done, for the people had a mind to work. Then the enemy comes in and says, blah, blah, blah. And then Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing. And there's so much rubbish that we're not able to build the wall. And our adversary said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. And then the other Jews said, and that's my phrase so we can see the continuity here of what he's trying to tell us. So it was when the Jews had dwelt near them, came, and they told us, they said 10 times, for whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. So you got the guys in the inner ranks that are failing. You got the enemy that's bringing a rally. And you got the guys in the outer ranks that are bringing incriminations and saying this is... So all sides of this thing is falling apart. Threefold. And, they say good things come in threes. Well, here's good things are bad things are coming in threes. And inner guys, the outer guys, the enemies, everyone's going, oh, man, it's terrible. We're not able to do this. But just 4 verses before this, they had it halfway done, and for the people had a mind to work. Well, what happened in between there? That's what I want to know. I think there's no statement of what happened. We see that the enemy had made some taunts, but that had already happened before. I think what's going on here is this, very simply. It's the realities of difficulties and adversity. One half of the work had been done, but the other half still had to be done. And the last half of a job is always harder than the first half of the job. I'm really good at starting stuff. But please don't ask Colleen how many things I've started and not finished. Opposition also became obvious. There was a true fear and crisis of faith that began to set in. It's not uncommon, by the way, for a crisis of faith to follow a small victory. This is not an incrimination. It's not even to say, I think it'd be very fair to blame the guys to say that they were being carnal when they got half of it done and people set their mind. I don't think that's an incriminating statement at all. It's not a statement of lack of faith, a lack of dependence on God, of independence. I think it's just the reality. They had a victory, and shortly after victory, many times comes the fall. There's an emotional side of that. There's a mental side of that. There's a letting down of the guard. And then just quickly after this oftentimes happens. The results of diligence is what follows beyond this. In 4:15 and following, it says, so it happened when our enemies heard that we knew and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. They just got back to work and did it. So we labored in the work, and half of the men held the spears from the daybreak until the stars appeared. And at the same time, I also said to the people, let each man, his servants, stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day. So they were partying by day. So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. In other words, we just kept at it. We would sleep in our clothes at night, we'd work in our clothes in the day, and we were just diligent to get this thing done. Didn't mean to have that twice. And so, you smell the pizza? Okay, it's time to quit. I'll pick this up next week. But let me just close on this. There are numerous ways to approach the application of what Nehemiah does and how he works and his diligence. It works within the church. It works the same applications within the family, the same applications within our own personal life. And there are so many points down through this thing that we'll begin to see as this begins to unravel. That this is a man that's faithful. He always keeps the Lord first. He makes prayer a priority. And he realizes the need to rally everyone together to work on this thing and to see this through and to keep pushing it and to the completion. And it's just the way it is, and we so easily fall to the side and begin to forget where we need to be going. Within the family, the same is true. And it's so needful for us to build walls, to protect, and to realize the threats of the enemy, how the enemy is working, how they're going to try to invade our company, how they're going to try to tear us down from the inner ranks, from the outer ranks, and bring accusations against us as an enemy themselves. And this is true within our personal lives as well. The same enemy works from within us with our own doubts. The same enemy works from without us to bring accusations against us. But we all have the Spirit of God living within us, telling us to stand up and to fight the fight, to put on the armor of God, and to keep doing the work. And I hope that Nehemiah is an encouragement to us. We'll see more of him next week. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your grace. Thank you for the story of Nehemiah. Thank you for his diligence, for an example that he was to us. And I pray that you'll help us to remember to stand, to fight, to be diligent, to do the work that you'd have us to do, to not lose sight of that which you've called for us to do. Thank you for the men that have gone to this retreat. I pray that it is it was a time of refreshment for them, and they'll come back and revived. And I pray for us as families that you'll help us to be united together to work for your glory, for your kingdom, for your honor, and that we would accomplish great things for you. Give us wisdom as we go out throughout the day. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.